This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn. Download the MP3 of our produced show with them at onbeing.org. So I was telling them at Nashville Public Radio today, I was telling them the story of how we had the invitation to come do an event in Nashville, and Trent Gilliss, who's here somewhere, put a note out on Facebook and Twitter and asking people who we should interview. And so a bunch of names came back, and then your two names came back, and I just hadn't connected you to Nashville. And you don't know this, I haven't told you this yet, but we intersected in a place far from Nashville. We didn't meet, but in Tecate at Rancho La Puerta.
No.
Yeah. Was that 2 years ago? I don't know how often you go there.
Two years ago, goodness.
At New Year's, I think.
Oh, New Year's,
yes.
Right.
And I thought, these people are so lovely. They're lovely musicians and lovely people. So when your names came across, I said, that's it.
Oh, my gosh.
And here we are.
This is good.
Yeah. So, and Abigail, I know that you have a habit of bursting out into song spontaneously, and I want to encourage you to do that tonight if you feel like it. You can dance, anything that... Or if you want to grab your banjo, okay. If we have half as much, if this is half as delightful for you all as it was for me preparing, then we're going to have a good hour here. And we'll have one more song from them at the end. And we are recording this for a later broadcast. So I will do a radio thing somewhere in the middle. And also, just finally, I want to say, do you like my boots? Because
my
I can never wear these boots in Minnesota in May.
Oh.
And I thought, I'm coming to Nashville.
So hot.
Okay. All right. So, you know, where I always start my conversations, whether I'm talking to a physicist or a banjo player, is I'd like to hear a little bit about whether there was a religious or spiritual background to your childhood. And Abigail, I'd like to start with you.
Right.
You grew up in a few places, Chicago, Washington, Minnesota a little bit.
I forgot that you were going to study.
That
me.
I become an expert
I'm,
on.
Yes,
I have.
Yes. I'm.
Oh, my. Well, my grandmother, who was in Evanston, Illinois most of her life, raised my mother there, a Unitarian Universalist.
Uh-huh.
And then I was also raised by my mother and my brother, Unitarian Universalist. And if people don't know what that is, just in case, Unitarian, I think, you know, in the faith we're learned to never think we know everything. So, but it means the unity, or the Trinity is the unity. All gods are one God. And Universalism means universal salvation. All people are and will be saved. And everybody takes their own walk, their own path in that and to that salvation. And it's something for us to learn from in our own faith. And I was raised from 3 to 11 years old in Montgomery Village, Maryland, and the religious education in that UU church, we actually went to everybody else's church. We learned about what it was like to go to temple or synagogue or mosque, all kinds of different churches, and we were learning about that to inform our own faith.
Mm-hmm.
And
intentionally, that was a plan.
Yeah, that was the religious education curriculum. Yeah. And I was also living in a place, Montgomery Village, Maryland, which is just outside of Washington, D.C., which is incredibly diverse. So I grew up going to dinner at my friend Lisa's house, and they called God Adonai, and we went to my friend Young's house, and they said Buddha. And I went to Shariar's house, and they said Allah. And my friend Lauren and their parents prayed to Jesus before dinner. And all these people, to me, were God. And then I moved to my parents, who are here in the audience from Oregon.
So
they are so wonderful and sweet, and they're here. Yeah. I hope I can't see them, though, because that would really freak me out. I love you. We moved to Minnesota. We moved to Edina, Minnesota, and my dad at that point was making really good money, and we moved to a wealthy suburb of Minneapolis. And my mom recalls the story that when I came home from school the first day, I said, "Mom, where are all the people?"
I was going to say Edina, Minnesota is not what you just described in Maryland.
No. And what I meant was, why is everybody white? Mm-hmm. And for the first time in my life, I felt what it was like to feel like an other, to feel different, and to feel in the margins, even though for the first time in my life I actually looked like everyone. And it was a very strange feeling. And the religious education at that church in Minneapolis was all about social action and community service informing our faith. And so I ended up working at a domestic violence shelter, helping to intake young people that were coming in with their parents, their mothers. And I ended up working at an AIDS hospice and stayed there for about 3 or 4 years volunteering. And I was the kid in high school that instead of having like band posters on my wall, I had Martin Luther King Jr. and Gandhi and the United Nations mural. And instead of going to my senior prom, I decided to go to the United Nations Youth Disarmament Conference in Canada. And I ended up coming back in time for prom because a cute guy asked me. But I actually did think that was more important, you know, to go to the UN Youth Disarmament Conference. Wow. But so that was my childhood, as much as I should probably say. Mm. And by the time I was leaving high school and going off for all the different adventures, the next chapter, I would say that I was, I believe that my faith and my spiritual path was about cultivating myself for good action.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we'll come back to that. Bela, how do you think about the religious or spiritual background of your childhood? However you think about that now. You grew up in New York.
Yeah, I was raised a harmless heathen.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So my mother's family's Jewish. Mm-hmm. My father's family wasn't, but they were split up when I was a kid. And actually, I didn't meet him until I was in my 40s when I searched him out, which is another story. And but it wasn't an observing kind of family or. You know, we did the biggies, you know, Passover and Hanukkah. But I don't feel like, I know I didn't feel like I had any kind of religious or spiritual thing going on as I grew up. I think I was looking for something when the banjo turned up.
Right.
And it sort of took the place of a lot of that for me. It sort of became my most important thing. And a lot of the things in religion, you know, you can find in music, too. So I'm hoping that that's going to work out for me.
Yeah. I think it's done fine.
If there's a hereafter.
Yeah, just largely have your banjo with you. I sense that your mother must have communed musically, if not spiritually, with music also. This is so fascinating. She named you after not one, but three Central European composers.
Yeah, actually, that was my father, who I didn't know, and he named, believe me, I got the better names than my older brother. I won't go
really?
Into that right now.
What are your three names, Bela?
Bela Anton Leos Fleck.
Yeah. I remember if it was a boy, he would name them, and if it was a girl, she would name the girl. But it ended up being two boys.
Really?
Yeah.
So after Bartok, Janáček.
Leos Janáček.
And
Anton Webern.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So some pretty out there stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But not banjo music. I mean, different out there in a different way.
Well, it could be.
It could be. Well, you've done that. But I mean, the banjo also wasn't your first instrument. You played French horn, right?
That's
in
a
high
bit
school.
Of a myth.
Is it?
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah. What happened was.
There you go. You can't believe everything you read on the internet.
It's true. I took a test for this school. Uptown called, I guess it's the FAME School, because this is in New York City. It was called Music and Art. There's actually several schools that the FAME television show and movie were based on, Music and Art, Art and Design. And I think there was a third one. But anyway, I tried out for it, and which meant I took a musical aptitude test, and I played guitar at that time. I played some folk songs. Mm-hmm. I had a killing version of Here Comes the Sun. Which
he still plays on occasion.
Really?
Yeah, on guitar. And I got into the school playing that. And I think I was rated number three of possible talent, with four being the most talented. Because we found all this stuff out. You know, we found out what you're rating, and which is pretty weird. I don't think they should have told anybody that. But anyway, when I got in the school, there was no guitar teaching or anything like that. And so they said, well, we'll put you on a real instrument, and we need a French horn really badly.
Okay, got it.
So they put me in a room, and I tried to play French horn for a season and never got the first. I could never even get the F, which is the first note you play on a French horn. I could never even make the first note until finally they said, you know, we don't have very many boys in the chorus. And I was moved into the chorus where I just sort of screamed all the way through high school. Meanwhile, I was learning to play the banjo on the side.
And you discovered the banjo. You were captivated by Earl Scruggs.
Yeah, Earl Scruggs, the Beverly Hillbillies theme, which actually, you know, people talk about a come-to-God moment. And for most banjo players of note in the bluegrass world, hearing Earl Scruggs is that moment. Hmm. And there's before and after.
So tell us about that. What is that? What is it that happens in that moment?
So awesome. It was, I remember it was like lights going off in my, every note was like a light going off in my brain. And this was way before I got my first banjo. This is before I played guitar. I never had the ego at that time to believe that, that I could actually play the banjo when I finally found out what it was. But it was just an amazing sound. And now I try to explain it as being a high tech yet primitive sound. Because it's not just like a computer can play fast, but you don't get excited, you know. But there's something so earthy and deep, especially about the way Earl Scruggs played, which turned people into believers.
Mm-hmm. Mm. You know, what did you say a minute ago? You said something about real. I mean, you've said this before, that people talk about the banjo as though it's not a real instrument. Which then, I guess, gets at the question of how we define real. Right, and I think you're both really eloquent. Well, first of all, I think it's fascinating that neither one of you—you're both actually came from the North. Neither one of you like grew up surrounded by banjo and bluegrass. You became believers, as you said. So talk about that, about the reality. Like, what is real?
What is
about
real?
This music that captured you, that just takes you away?
Well, my come-to-God moment in the folk music world was hearing an LP of Doc Watson.
Yeah.
Singing and playing Shady Grove.
Yeah.
Is this where you want me to bust into song?
Yeah, I do. I was hoping you'd ask.
Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove, my darling, Shady Grove, my little love, I'm going back to Harlan. When I heard that sound, and Doc singing it... For me, there was this moment where I just knew I was hearing, and I should preface this, that I was really immersed in China at this point,
yeah,
and loving Chinese culture and studying the language really intensely and been there a number of times. And when I heard Doc Watson, I felt like I heard the beauty of authentic American culture. And I wanted it so badly. I'd been looking for it so badly. And I finally heard it when I heard Doc, this high, lonesome, searching, struggling, suffering, hopeful voice singing this ancient melody and these old words. And it didn't matter who owned it or where it came from, but this man was sharing it with me. And I knew that I had to go get a banjo and I had to learn Shady Grove. And instead of doing karaoke in China with my clients when I would become a lawyer someday, I would play ballads from Appalachia, of course.
Can I throw something in?
Yeah.
For me, what I think, the word I thought of when you were talking about that, what you actually heard was the truth. Something that was the truth. And I think that the greatest musicians that, when I think about, and even like B.B. King, who we just lost, but Earl Scruggs and even Miles Davis, some of these people that played something that somehow seemed so profound, and these are just instrumentalists. Abby's talking about Doc Watson, who could use words, you know, but it just sounds so true, even though it's just notes, you know, there's something more about it.
And this notion of roots, like roots music, which, again, it's language we throw around. But when you start talking about what the music conveys and where it comes from, you realize how deep that is and what it touches in us.
Well, something that I learned from a movie that Bela made, and this isn't a plug, this is just the truth. I watched Bela's documentary, Throw Down Your Heart, and you called me on your big global phone from over in Africa a number of times. And I think it was when you were in Tanzania. He was learning the story of how on that side, the journey of the banjo to America.
You were tracing the original roots of the banjo in Africa.
Yeah,
right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what he had learned, and part of the reason the documentary is called "Throw Down Your Heart," is because as people were being boarded onto the slave ships, they said, "Throw your heart down here. You're not going to want to carry it to where you're going." And a lot of the slave masters figured out that if they had a banjo player on board playing the music of home, more of the cargo would live to the other side. So the origins of the banjo in America are the bitterest of roots. Mm-hmm. Makes me want to cry just thinking about it in this moment. And it formed an amazing origin to what became a blend of traditions from Africa, Ireland, and Scotland, when those fiddlers and those banjo players from Africa and those fiddlers from Scotland and Ireland started playing plantation dances together. That's what really started what we know of as that early Appalachian and that early American sound, at least for that part of America. And that sound is based in this bitter root, but with this actual hope, that I can live. That I can live, I can survive. It's an amazing tradition.
Yeah, and I think that hope is something that you feel in the music, along with, just the song you just sang. Sorry, what's the name of that, the song you sang starting?
Oh, And Am I Born to Die?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a little light ditty.
Yeah. No, but that's the thing. This kind of music takes us to the hard, bitter, sorrowful places of life and also insists on the hope and humanity that
it's
is
insistent.
Right there,
yeah.
Not in spite of it, but woven into it.
Yeah. That's where I hear the truth, yeah.
Yeah. There's a story you've told about your son, Juno. By the way, where does his name come from? I don't know any Central European composers named with the first name Juno.
My grandmother's name was June Carvel.
Okay.
And June was a fabulous woman.
Okay.
In fact, she got us to play our first show together as a duo. She loved Bela so much. And she insisted that we play a show at her Unitarian Universalist Church.
Okay.
So that was our first show together. And she ran a roller skating rink in downtown Chicago for a long, long time, along with her husband, Alan. And she's a formidable woman. She inline skated an inline skating marathon at the age of 84.
And she won. But she was the only contestant in her age group. But she finished. Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And she had a wonderful sense of humor as she was getting very old and not remembering things. And, you know, she'd get in the grandma loop where they say the same thing again and again, you know. Oh, did I order the omelet? I want the omelet, you know. Grandma, you've ordered it four times, you know. She would laugh at herself. She laughed at herself until the moment she died. Mm. And we love her so much. And so when Juno was born, which was just about a year and a half or two after she died, it was actually Bela's mother who thought of the idea of
naming him Juno.
It's
a great name, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and so to this idea of the reality and the truth in this music, there's a story you told. The first track on your new album, which is your first album together, is I've Been Working on the Railroad, which you sing in a minor key. But I love this this story that you told about how, maybe this isn't true either, correct me if I heard this on the internet.
Well, our publicist writes a lot of these stories.
So maybe Bela, you were traveling, and Abigail, you were home with Juno, and Juno was banging on the table.
Yeah.
And you got really excited about that, which, you know, this is a life lesson for other parents who are not musicians, because you thought, he's learning rhythm.
Yes,
banging
I
on
was
the
so
table.
Excited, yeah.
And
because he was banging in time. It was consistent.
He was banging in time? Are you sure?
Close enough.
That's a fair question.
But what I remembered is when I was learning to cross-country ski in Minnesota, somebody taught me how to keep my pace by singing I've Been Working on the Railroad. And I think, here's the thing, I think a lot of people might think, oh, bluegrass music or folk music is not my music, it's not my taste. And yet, so much of this music is like woven into our lives in ways that we don't even reflect on.
Yeah.
I don't think, well, let me put it this way. Some bluegrass music might not be your taste, but some other bluegrass music might be. And if you just let the name bluegrass repel you because you just heard some bluegrass you didn't like, you'll miss out on a bunch of great music. And I think whenever we decide we don't like a kind of music, we're the one that loses, because there's always something in every field that's beautiful that you would like.
Yeah. And it was kind of revelatory for me to think about this when I was getting ready to talk to the two of you.
This is not folk music, but the first thing I thought of was when we were learning baby CPR, they taught us to sing Stayin' Alive, actually. Mm-hmm. Stayin' Alive, Stayin' Alive.
Really?
Right, that's the tempo.
That's the tempo, yeah.
That you're supposed to.
Wow.
Yeah.
So if anybody out there is in trouble right now, BGs can help you out.
Music and parenting. I'd like to circle back to China.
Yeah.
Because this is an amazing part of your story. But it's a little cleaned up in the way it gets told. So I was really happy. You know, it's just like, I mean, it is an amazing story. You become fluent. You're going to go to law school in China, in Beijing. And then you hear Doc Watson and you pick up the banjo. But I also found something you wrote about how it wasn't an immediate love affair with China.
Right.
Right? And when the story gets condensed, it's just that love of that passion that's there for you now. You wrote about, you know, you were at Colorado College and you saw this sign tacked to a bulletin board in a dank and narrow path leading to the university cafeteria, study Chinese in China.
So dramatic.
Yeah. And you talked about that first time you went there for the summer and you're sweating profusely on a July day. And, you know, you said, my interaction with the Chinese people could be broken into two categories. One, they aggressively try to sell me stuff. Two, they practice their English on me. I hated the way China made me feel unwanted, like a resource for exploitation. But so you had this experience of being there and feeling outside, but then you went back and you were drawn in. So talk a little bit about, I'm just interested in that kind of trajectory about what it, and so again, you know, then you decided you were going to be there for world peace and you were going to go study, you were going to study law and you learned China. But what was the revelation when you heard Doc Watson singing Shady Grove that was connected to that and yet took you in a completely different direction with it?
Well, at the point I'd heard Doc Watson, I had already fallen in love with China.
Right.
And at that point, rather than feeling like an outsider that was frustrated that I couldn't get in, I was starting to feel like someone who was finding a place there. And I would hear people, you know, once I could speak a little bit, I could start to hear what people were saying about Americans. And I had traveled other places in the world and was hearing things that people were saying about Americans too. This was the early 90s, and kind of thought of us as big bullies and homogenizers and people that wanted the world to be like them. And a lot of people thought of Hollywood right away, real dangerous movies. People would be like, "Well, 不想去那个洛杉矶, you know, I don't want to go to Los Angeles because I'll get shot." Everybody gets shot in Los Angeles in the movies, you know, so. I wasn't thinking about it consciously, but when I heard Doc Watson, I realized that I really needed to find what it was about America that I could believe in so strongly and stand in front of my Chinese friends and be like, look, this is real and this is beautiful and this is something I want to share with you and I'm proud of. This is a part of who I am. It was much about self-discovery as it was about sharing right. something beautiful from my culture.
Hmm. And then there was that, I mean, you said this a minute ago, how you'd really become so, I think you used the word obsessed with China's deep ancient culture and that realization that this music actually carried that depth and that age in those layers of history and time.
That's exactly right. I mean, people talk about America being a new country, and indeed we are a new nation in comparison to most around the world, and especially in comparison to China. But the music, just like I learned in Bela's film, that banjo comes from Africa. It comes from these ancient civilizations that have been making gourd banjos with hide heads and gut strings for centuries. And it comes from Ireland and Scotland, and where these melodies have been, you know, to medieval times and before. And that came to America, and it became this beautiful new form of this beautiful new sound of suffering and hope.
Yeah.
It's ancient.
By the way, I was trying desperately to get Pete Seeger to do an interview for my film, and I would call him up, and he'd say, "Oh, I'm far too busy," and then he would talk to me for 3 hours about the history of the banjo, and so try him again in a few months. So I tried him again in a few months. Same exact thing happened, and what he said in both conversations, pretty much the same thing, was, the banjo doesn't actually come from Africa. It came down the Tigris-Euphrates River. It's down through the trade routes into Africa. It actually comes from... So I was like, wait, are you saying that America's instrument is actually from Iraq? This was like during the Iraq War.
Yeah.
I thought, wow, this is great. But unfortunately, I never got to do that interview with him.
Oh.
Yeah.
Do you think that's right? Have you traced that history?
Well, he seemed to think so. Yeah. He seemed to know what he was talking about.
You gotta want to believe Pete Seeger.
Yeah, I mean... I don't fact check Pete Seeger. I probably should. But.
That's good. Yeah. What did you learn in that journey that you took? Was there anything you learned that really kind of opened up the instrument for you in new ways?
I think for me it was more like I was. This was after about 15 years straight of the Flecktone, Bela Fleck and the Flecktones.
Yeah.
And that was an area where we had a lot of control. As a group, like we, except live, we improvised a lot, but in the studio or in the composing, there was a lot of control. I found that whenever we would invite someone to guest with us and get up on stage with us, and we had nobody knew what was going to happen, all these awesome things would happen that we never could have planned. So when I went to Africa, part of it was there was no way I could be prepared for what was going to happen in Africa.
When you played music with and for people?
Right, because I was there for 6 weeks, and almost every day I was playing and recording with people I'd never met before, playing music that in most cases I couldn't learn ahead of time. So I had to sort of just let go and let things happen a lot of the time and sort of allow... And it's sort of kind of like a fight or flight response. You could look at it that way, or you could say it's a spiritual thing, that something comes in to help you when you need it the most. But it seems as I got to go back and study what happened on that trip, those are the moments that are the most magical, is when nobody had time to plan and we just started playing. And I was able, because I edited the movie, I had some control on the back end, and I could make sure that that's what you guys heard when you saw it. But I think it was a lot about that odd combination of being prepared and practicing and working and caring and doing everything you can to be ready. But when it comes down to the moment, you have to let go and throw all that away and hope that the gods are with you, if there are gods.
Yeah.
Bela called me while he was over there, and you were almost having a nervous breakdown. You were like, they're playing, and I don't know where the one is. I can't find the one.
What do you mean, the one? Just the beat?
Yeah, like,
where's the downbeat?
Really?
African music is so layered and so rhythmically complex that,
yeah.
And if you ask somebody over there, they don't really know what you're talking about. Everybody knows their part. They've been playing it. They learned it. A lot of it was passed down from centuries and villages that all play. This family plays this part of the beat. That part of the family plays that part of the beat. And, you know, when they all get together to play music, they go into their thing, and it all just is this incredible gel. And so to try and figure out how to play in that music was overwhelming. And what Abby said is, well, I don't think you actually have to know to play good music. I think this is where you let go and you play what comes to you, and it'll be okay.
And it was.
I said anything that deep. I think I just said, can't you just play something that sounds good?
Yeah. That's pretty much the same thing. If it sounds good, then that should be good enough.
Yeah.
Right. In that situation. Mm-hmm. And then there were some songs I could prepare for, mm-hmm. And those ones I could know where I thought the beat was.
Mm. And you two have also, you've gone to China as well, right? I know you go back there.
Yeah, I've been there 3 times, and one time we got to go to Tibet together. Uh-huh. And so it was apparently one of the first American and Chinese-sponsored trips over there, which was a pretty incredible experience for both of all of us. We were with the Sparrow Quartet at that time with Casey Dreeson and Ben Soley, and we had a pretty incredible experience over there.
Yeah.
Had our guards and
our minders.
Our minders and, yeah.
Protecting.
We'd get to a new town and the same person would walk by. Wait.
It's true.
But have you also been over there kind of not just taking this music, but also collecting their music and doing some...
You did your Silk Road trip.
Yeah, I've done a number of... On almost every trip I've done, I've tried to collaborate with somebody locally no matter where I end up. Mm-hmm. And I just ask somebody, the sound guy or whatever, or, you know, really if you're doing a proper tour, you're being handled by the Cultural Bureau, the Central... Yeah. Ministry of Culture, and so I would call ahead or ask someone in our party to call ahead and see if we could collaborate with somebody really, you know, great in each town who plays some kind of folk music, and that has led to meeting the most incredible, wonderful local musicians all over China. So right. I feel like I have gotten to jam and play with Uyghurs, Tibetans, Mongolians, Dong people, Han, wonderful Han folk music players from all over China. And I had one really memorable experience that was of being in a city and calling ahead and asking for someone to come. And this old man showed up backstage and he had an arhu case. And an arhu is a little two-stringed instrument, actually, but the bow goes in between both of the strings. And it sounds...
Snakeskin covered. Banjo, really, that's a violin. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, tiny, tiny head, and it sits on your knee, and you play it.
Sounds like a human voice, almost.
It sounds like a human voice to some and a dying cat to others. It really depends.
Right.
I happen
like
to love
Bill
it.
Like Bill Monroe. can we cut that out?
I get to edit this one, maybe. I'll decide later.
And he showed up, and he saw me in this wonderful band of musicians that I was there with from America, and he just didn't look happy at all. He looked at me and said, "中国人和美国人不能一起合作音乐." Americans and Chinese simply cannot play music together. It's too different. And I looked at him and I was like, "Oh, okay." Well, would you just play for us then? And he pulled out his arhu and he started playing this breathtakingly gorgeous melody from Tibet, actually. And the band, as we were listening, we just started to tune up our instruments to match his tuning, and we just started playing along with him. And you could see this. It was barely there, but you could see just that corner of his mouth kind of turn up ever so slightly. And that night we performed that song that we created in that moment for 1,400 people in a theater in that town. Mm. And at the end of the show, he came up to me and he said, tonight I discovered something. It's not that Americans and Chinese can't play music together. It's just that music is actually the communication of hearts. Mm. And that, to me, became the whole... Well, that's enough, yeah. You get it.
Ironically, just to bust in for a second, I have had extremely parallel experiences back when I was in Newgrass Revival in the 80s, the 1980s. And
Yes. That's kind of the century where my mind went. Yeah.
That's good. And we got to do these State Department tours, USIS, USIA, which are basically, they call them propaganda tours. But we got to go to India and Bangladesh. We got to go to a lot of amazing places. And at a certain point, I realized that we had like an ambassador status. I started cabling ahead and saying, find me musicians. You know, when I get there, I want to jam with somebody. People would show up. You know, we'd get to a country, and I'd get to play with these people, and they'd start out like, what is just like Abby said, what is this? Why, you know, why am I here? Why do I have to do this? And when we'd start to play, and the whole room would change. It was like almost the color had changed from this dark to technicolor, you know, like the Wizard of Oz, you know, when you land in Oz. And so it was such an exciting thing. That was part of what made me feel confident that going to Africa could be that way, because I'd had that experience over and over again. And when the Flecktones got the opportunity to do a trip like that to the Pacific Rim, we made it a point that every country we went to, somebody from the local culture would come on stage and perform with us. Mm. And it broke the ice like nothing. It felt so great to do, but that was the favorite part of the show, obviously, for the locals, because we were celebrating their culture, and we had taken the time to learn something of their music, which was really, it just really was a great thing. Mm. So, but we both came to this separately, and it's one of the...
And then we found each other.
And then we found each other.
Well, and so that that aspiration, that very kind of American ambition you had to go to law school and make policy and change the world, this is a whole other way into the same thing at a human level.
Mm-hmm.
That's... Bela, you have said, and I do again believe you really said this, that the first time you heard Abigail's music, you were listening in the car and you got stopped for speeding.
Yeah. Yeah, it was out Franklin. There was a party.
Because you were just so caught up in the...
So romantic.
Yeah, she gave me... In fact, I it's not really the first time. It's been slightly sanitized story. The first time I heard her, it was at a party, and she was playing these very, very sad, slow songs with a bunch of girls gathered around her, and I was going, this is just not for me, you know. It was just really slow, and it was beautiful, but I was like, yeah, okay. She's good, you know. But then she gave me this CD at this party, and I started listening to it, and I had a completely different experience because the banjo was up front, there was this groove to it, and she was singing like you just heard her with this ancient sound, very connected to traditional music, and I just started driving faster and faster and going, wow, I really like this. I think I was even talking to myself, and then I got pulled over and had to walk the line.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to do my radio thing now. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being, today with musicians Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn in a public conversation at the Belcourt Theater in Nashville, Tennessee. You know, it seems to me, Bela, that your story is also about kind of, not as much as it's about traveling through places, it's about traveling through genres, kind of, I don't know, as an old Star Trek lover, taking the banjo where no banjo has gone before.
Mm.
Or at least maybe we don't all know that it's gone there before.
Wait, could you do that, Abby?
I can't remember it. How does it go?
That's good.
Yeah, although I'm more of a next generation fan. See, and there are clearly people in the audience who know what we're talking about. I have to say, the titles of the Flecktones albums are really intriguing. Flight of the Cosmic Hippo.
By the way, we had a bus driver recently, and he said, man, I love the Flecktones. I said, really? He said, yeah, I got your album. I said, which album? He said, oh, you know, the one with the pig on the cover.
Which one was that?
Flight of
the Cosmic Hippo. So it didn't have a hippo on the cover.
It had a hippo on the cover.
It did have a hippo on the cover. I see. Okay. And then there's UFO Tofu.
That's a palindrome. It spells the same thing backwards. And so we had a long piece.
Oh, I see. Yeah, it
we
does.
Had a long piece. Well, we had a musical piece that was a palindrome that was about 5 minutes long that all went forward and went backwards. It had about six different palindromes buried within it. And that was where, and so we used to tell stories about palindromes before we do that song, and that one popped up. A guy named Baby Gramps told us about that one, and Yeah.
That's great. Mm-hmm. And then three flew over the cuckoo's nest.
Yeah, we were searching hard at that point.
Yeah, you got to... You really hit the peak with UFO tofu palindromes. We did a show. We did an event in New York City in the fall about Bach. It was during the Bach month with a computer scientist and a Bach lover, and we actually put this recording, this amazing recording of you playing Bach's Partita for Violin Number 3 on the banjo on our website. It was so gorgeous.
You have incredible taste.
Thank you. but I was then also really amazed to learn that you've written a concerto for banjo with the, and you did it with the Nashville Symphony Orchestra, with the 80-piece symphony orchestra. Very intrigued by the title, The Imposter, that you gave to that. Would you talk about...
Sure, yeah, and really The Imposter, and Abby and I have talked about feeling like you're the outsider, you're the other.
Yeah, it kind of comes back to this idea that the banjo is not a real instrument.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And especially, and I realized at some point that I'm always putting myself in positions playing the banjo where it hasn't really been played, not always, but often putting myself in positions where the banjo hasn't been played before, so I have to figure out a role for the banjo with Indian musicians or with Chinese musicians or with classical musicians or with jazz musicians. And the only place I really know exactly what the banjo is supposed to do is bluegrass. That's the place where I know exactly what almost every banjo player of note has played since Earl Scruggs from till now. I know how they would do things, and I can make my choices based on an understanding. But everywhere else, I'm kind of waiting for somebody to say, "Hey, you're not supposed to be in here. Get out of here." You know. So that's a feeling that I sometimes get when I'm feeling insecure, like somebody's going to catch me and kick me out. And yeah. And so with The Imposter, you know, playing in front of a symphony orchestra and writing the piece and everything too, I had my ears peeled for somebody to eject me.
Yeah. And then there's this place at the very end where the banjo kind of breaks free from the rest of the orchestra. And did that symbolize
in
for
writing
you?
In writing the piece, I was making a serious attempt not to do a... Appalachian concerto. The most expected thing to do with a banjo is to like put it in a show it off in its traditional glory within an orchestra, and I really wanted this to be a piece where the banjo was not that. And that's kind of often that's what I find myself doing, is trying to prove that the banjo can be viable not just as a traditional instrument, but for the sound and the abilities that it has that no other instrument has. But by the end of the piece, I had been trying hard, to complete this piece, and I wasn't coming up with a big ending.
Right.
And that's when desperately I reached for Earl Scruggs, and he was there for me. and not only that, I dedicated the piece to Earl Scruggs and got to play it for him before the premiere, and he came to the premiere, and it was the last concert that he came to.
Really?
Yeah, and he passed away maybe five or six months later.
Oh.
So it was some closure there.
Yeah.
But he was very sweet.
It felt to me like, you really have come full circle. I mean, I read that you, when you first started getting into banjo and bluegrass, you were trying to cover up your accent.
Yeah.
And then, here you are kind of really bringing all these things together. And even you've also, isn't there a song in your album you've done together from Béla Bartók?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So you've actually come back to your namesake.
Really, when I started writing that piece, that was when I finally said, look, I got to get into this Bartók stuff. It's people keep asking me, you must really be a Bartók fan because he was always exploring folk music and classical music. And I'm like, well, I really haven't heard very much of it. And I think because of the complexity of my relationship with the person who gave me that name,
yeah,
I wasn't eager to embrace it. But at the point when I was writing this piece, it was like, okay, let's just deal with all of this stuff.
Yeah,
and
you
so
had
I started
met your
listening.
Father at that point.
Yeah.
You had some kind of...
A lot of the sort of Darth Vaderism had sort of subsided by making him into a real person. And then I was ready to go face Bartók, which turned out to be some of the greatest music I ever heard.
Really?
Oh, my
really?
God. It's so different. It's so free from convention and imaginative. And I love it. I really do. So, yeah, so I found a couple of piano pieces and arranged them for Abby and I to play on the new album. That was the first Bartok that I've done. But I'd like to actually try to learn a violin concerto on the banjo and things like that. That would be a lot of fun.
The two of you do something which you did here just before we started, which is kind of unusual, singing and the banjo and song together. And I've seen you both talk about this, the music you do together in terms of like dialogue and conversation.
Well, that's Abby. Like, I am not a talker. This is a lot for me.
Okay, you're doing really well.
Thank you.
You're really holding your own.
But if you came to a Flecktone show, maybe there would be speaking two or three times in the whole night, and it would be brief. And I part of it was intentional, that it was like, we want the music to speak, and we want it to be about that. But Abby is a great storyteller, and she reaches out to the audience and really gets to know them and talks a lot. So I've had to learn to come to terms with that and participate in that as well.
We'd get off stage after the first couple of shows, and he'd say, I don't know how to put this, but could we talk a little less, maybe?
We only had time for like 5 songs in a 2-hour set. I was trying to get the song ratio up a little bit.
But I didn't necessarily... Okay, so there is the literal conversation, but there's also the kind of the dialogue between the banjo and the voice, and also the dialogue between your two... when you're both playing the banjo, different kinds of banjo and different styles, and right?
Oh, on stage, like as a part of our performance, yes.
Yeah.
I think a real intention when we were finally taking our thing together seriously, not just our love for one another, but our ability to perform together, which really hit when we realized we're going to have a baby. So we decided that we needed to really make an effort to put out something in the world that was like a formal offering musically as a duo.
So that we could travel together and not be split up like so many couples that have babies and one of the two of them travels. So we decided we'd throw our forces together and
hit the road.
Take the baby with us. And that's what we've been doing for the last couple of years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so when we were planning our record, we thought, we know that two banjos and a vocal can be a really wonderful thing, but we actually do have to prove it. So we decided to create soundscapes that differed from track to track and that differed from song to song, which meant including different types of banjos. There's back in the late 1800s, there were actual banjo orchestras all over America. They were really popular. There were big double banjo basses with end pins that people stood and played, and they looked like taiko drums with strings on them, and piccolo banjos and banjo ukes and banjo lins, and it goes on, banjo cellos.
Why did that go away? Why?
Exactly, right?
Yeah, I mean, why do we not even know this?
No.
Yeah.
And we find that to be so exciting, that there are there is this web and this family of banjos that have all these amazing different sounds to them. So it was really Bela's idea to bring in all of these different registers. And so Bela plays banjo uke on a song. I play cello banjo. He plays cello banjo. He actually created a banjo for the record.
Kind of a baritone banjo. There was just a missing register that was... But I think what's really going on the music sounds very natural and almost traditional because it's just two banjos playing together. But clawhammer banjo players like Abby and three finger players very rarely play together. And it's hard for us to think of any duos and historically that combine those two, and that's the whole band. That's what they do. But we tried to create a tapestry, and we have different techniques, but we both ripple. So when we get our rippling to line up together, it just works. Hmm. And the registers is a great help to keep it from all sounding the same. But also having something that's not rippling on top of that is very completing. And Abby's voice, you know, sings out over the top of those 16th notes. The 16th notes are the way a banjo, which doesn't have much sustain, creates the impression of sustain by repeating notes, hitting open strings, keeping things ringing. and you can really feel like there's a sustain and a soulful long note. But there's nothing like having a long-held note over the top of it. And that's why fiddle and banjo work so great, but vocals and banjo is fantastic.
But it's kind of unusual, isn't it? It's not, you know,
singing and banjo?
Yeah, singing and banjo.
I wouldn't think so. Because I think
the way you guys do it, no?
Well, I think it's personal to us, the way that we're doing it.
The way that we're doing it as a duo, just a banjo duo with vocal, is unique.
Okay.
But in old time music in particular, which is the tradition that I've been learning a lot from, I was actually in an all-girl old time string band. Mm-hmm. And there are so many women out there playing old timey banjo. I mean, you have to be in a certain strange, limited cult of people to actually enjoy this trance-like repetitive music. However, if you are in it, you do know that there are a lot of women that sit and play the banjo and sing old tunes. You know?
Okay.
But what I think is starting to happen now, and what I saw happening with Abby's music is, you know, when you think about a singer-songwriter, you think, oh, he plays the piano, Billy Joel, okay, you know, plays the guitar, James Taylor. They write their songs built around the way they're playing that instrument as they open their mouth and utter sound.
Right.
But it's hard to think of people that write songs on the band, you know, playing the banjo while they're composing their songs. And so I think that's when Abby writes her own songs, I hear that contemporary, that voice of today connected to, you know, the tradition that she loves, but in songs that are about her experience and that have a different tonality. And I think that's a new development.
Right.
And she's not the only one, but it's definitely, she's one of the great ones of it.
Oh, honey.
I, on your album too, as well, this album you produced together, there's one song called Banjo Banjo, one tune called Banjo Banjo, that in the liner notes, it says that you wrote that you sat down and made that music at when you first felt Juno kick, and was it in Tecate?
It was.
Maybe when we were together.
Yeah, the first writing session where that tune came out was in Tecate.
It was. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That it's such a special place for us. My grandmother June went there every year since they had those
just,
rail
cars.
We
should say it's the original health resort.
Yeah.
And now it's kind of a spa health resort, but it was very radical and suspect
in the
50
beginning.
Years ago.
Yeah. And my grandma was a part of that.
Uh-huh. And her ashes are spread there.
Her ashes are there, yeah.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. So it's a very important place for Abby's family.
Yeah.
But I have to say, you know, it's enviable, you know, to think about this being part of your marriage, your friendship and relationship, and a way that you can celebrate, you know, you can literally make music together.
It's great. I mean, we're constantly amazed by our situation. As we get to travel down the road with these very special people that Richard and Bebop and
my mom,
Abby's
often.
Mom and Helen that are like a support team that help us do these concerts and make it all happen. And it, you know, Juno goes to bed before the show usually and sleeps in the bunk, and it takes a lot of people to make all of that work, but it's really, we get to go out and play our music.
Yeah, it's a sweet, sweet situation. Yeah. Probably the hardest thing to do is to find time to make new music, because we wake up in the morning with Juno on the bus and the first thing we want to do is just go play with him and be with him, and so we do that. We spend several hours together with Juno until he falls asleep for his nap.
And then we're wiped out.
And then we're tired.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and I do have to say, because I have been watching the TV show Nashville.
Oh, yeah.
I am aware that this juggling music, making music, and a relationship can be challenging.
I don't know how Raina does it. I really don't.
I know. And now Juliet. Oh, my.
Yeah, I thought maybe I'd try to go visit Deacon in the hospital while I was here.
He'd love that. He'd really appreciate that.
What do you all think about having this Nashville TV show? Is it just a soap opera?
Oh,
is it fun?
Just fun.
It's like a it's a guilty pleasure. I mean, all the musicians that I know
me too.
From here, we all love it, and we, you know, it's neat to see our friends that are in the show. Occasionally, we see people who are extras on the show, or we hear people, you know, playing and see all the places we know. So yeah, we get a kick out of it.
Well, actually, what I love, you know, it's an evening soap opera like a lot of TV that I watch, but it's very joyful and wonderful the way music is part of the story, and just having the music in it adds this, and it is real music.
Yeah.
And those actors, most of them are real musicians, right?
Yeah. We definitely relate to the show in the in so many ways. I mean, I know it might be aggrandized or turned into something slightly more dramatic, just a little for the show, but you know, all the struggle with the record company or trying to find your own
right.
voice or, you know, being a parent and being a career woman or...
whether to tell the truth about your sexual orientation.
That's right. It really runs the gamut of life.
It sure does. Yeah.
Oh, this is fun. Something also that intrigued me, actually, neither one of you has a really extensive professional training, right? I mean, and this is you really came to this very late. But Bela, I mean, you are the premier banjo player possibly in the world. And when you did this, I was reading when you did this, when you did the concerto, you had to. This is fascinating that you used a computer to help you translate. You know, between the difference between what you knew and how to do this kind of orchestral composition, that you don't have real formal compositional
training.
Well, it was
the same problem I had in high school. There was nothing for the banjo. They didn't have a place to put me. And then when after high school, I moved to Boston, and I would have loved to have gone to Berkeley, but they didn't have a place to put me, you know, there either. So I just, you know, was trying to figure out music that I loved, you know, one note at a time. If I loved a Charlie Parker solo or a Coltrane solo, I just tried to figure out the first measure on the banjo and just gradually, you know, build up my own understanding of the banjo. So when trying to write a piece like that, it's not that I don't write music. I write banjo tablature. That's the way banjo players communicate about how we play. And the reason we use this number system for banjo communication is because there's a lot of places to play the same note, and those notes come fast. So it's not enough to know that it's a D. You need to know which D it is and what note's coming next. So it's better for me to see a 3 and a 7 and a 5 than, you know, then a D, an A, and a C. And banjo players will know what I'm talking about, what position
yeah,
I'm talking
yeah.
about.
Yeah,
right?
Totally. Yeah. I'm down.
Yeah.
I dig.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, which means when it came time to... And then when I play with people like the Flecktones or my bluegrass friends, Sam Bush and Jerry Douglas and Edgar Meyer, who's a great classical musician as well as everything else, I usually just bring a sketch and I trust them to fill it all in. Hmm. Great musicians that are improvisers will do that. You don't write out every note for them. But when you're writing for an orchestra, you have to. So how was I going to do that? Because I didn't have the skills to do that. And so I did it with using that banjo tablature and a computer program called Sibelius, where I could write the stuff in banjo tablature and then copy it and paste it onto a violin stave or a French horn stave. And it would turn it into notation that they could read. And then I could hand that notation to a copyist who could clean it up and make it legible. And it slowed me, you know, it slowed me down. But I honestly wasn't going very fast.
All right.
Anyway.
And, you know, Abigail, I have to say, when I first experienced the two of you, I also assumed that you were somebody who'd, you know, grown up learning this. And you are, you're very much considered to be now. You play with Bela Fleck, and, you know, the two of you
yes.
are this banjo-playing duo. And when you were pregnant, you know, some music reporter said, and now they will give birth to the holy banjo emperor, right? But part of what you've been out there talking about, and you delivered the commencement address for Colorado College for your alma mater, and you talked a lot about this way you were open to experience, and you really discovered this thing that has become defining, and in fact, you are defining, you know, you're helping to define this kind of music now in the culture, but it was very unexpected, and you didn't prepare for it all your life in a linear way.
Mm. Well, a piece of my story that I don't really ever tell because it just adds another 30 seconds is the fact that when I left Vermont on my road trip to go south before I was headed to China to become a lawyer, my very first stop was at the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies, and I spent 5 days meditating, and it was the first time I ever meditated in my whole life, and to this day it's one of the hardest things I've ever done. To sit still, my body ached, I became afraid I was hurting myself, and then I felt the voices inside my head telling me about all the times I had hurt, and I went into the darkest place, and one day I remember I was sitting there, it must have been 3 days in or something, and I went into this very deep place. Finally, I wasn't really thinking a whole lot, and I came out of it hours later, and my entire shirt was covered with tears and boogers. I mean, it was not pretty. And I in that moment, I stood up, and nobody was in the room. They had all left. And I know that I had let go of something major. I'm not even totally sure what it is to this day, but I know that I didn't really feel like a victim anymore when I left that place. I felt like I was clean and fresh and pure, and I could make my decisions. And that within days, I was in Louisville, Kentucky, playing the four songs I knew on the banjo, and was offered a record deal in Nashville, Tennessee. And I went to Nashville instead of, I came to Nashville instead of going to China to go to law school. And I felt ready for that. I felt ready. That's all I can say.
Were you always a singer? Or did that come later too?
Yeah, I always loved singing. I was in choir all through school. And yeah. I'd always try out for the solos, and I never got them. So I really didn't fancy myself much of a singer.
Yeah.
I didn't think I was going to be perceived as a good singer.
See, that's what I got out of getting ready to talk to you. You don't really consider yourself to be a great musician.
No.
You feel like this is something you came to late, and you, this imposter language. I mean, I don't think you do feel like an imposter, because you throw yourself into it so joyfully. But you don't think of yourself the way other people think of you as a musician.
Right. No, I don't. And I that is no harm or foul to how I feel about the music.
Yeah.
And I feel like music, just like most of my life, I hope that it's a service to people. This goes back to my childhood.
Yeah.
I do hope that I'm helping. I'm hoping that I'm continually, through the music, cultivating myself to have compassion and empathy and to express that to people. And, you know, I was talking to my mom today as we were walking around the lake, trying to just think of things from my childhood and not forget too much when I talk to you tonight. And, I was remembering what a sensitive child I was. I was so tuned in to everybody's feelings. And it was a beautiful thing, because I saw people's feelings before I saw them. And now I consider it a great gift, but at the time I didn't know how to manage it. And so I felt darkness a lot, because I immediately would recognize people feeling darkness. And
right.
Even in high school, a girl who had schizophrenia and talked to herself in the bathroom, I would just be friendly with her because I could see she was struggling. And the counselor said that she said, "I heard the voices too." You know, it was just really tuned into something there. And I saw that in my mom. You know, it comes to me honestly. And my whole life I've had to learn how to manage that. And a beautiful thing is that a song teaches me to manage that. Because I feel something so strong. Most songs I choose to sing, unless they're...
Because a song becomes a container for
it? It's a container for the empathy and for the sensitivity. So I can feel something so strongly. Like I've been singing the song Come All You Coal Miners, that was written by an amazing woman named Sarah Ogan Gunning. And she was raised in a coal camp, and her child starved to death because they couldn't get milk for her baby. And her husband died of black lung. And all of these things, I hear her story, and I'm crying, and I start to sing the song. Come all you coal miners, wherever you may be, and listen to a story that I'll relate to thee. My name is nothing extra, but the truth to you I'll tell. I am a coal miner's wife, I'm sure I wish you well. Coal mining is the most dangerous work in our land today, with plenty of dirty slaving work and very little pay. Coal miner, won't you stand up and open your eyes and see what the dirty capitalist system is doing to you and me. They'll take your very lifeblood. They'll take your children's lives. Take fathers away from children and husbands away from wives. Coal miner, won't you organize wherever you may be and make this a land of freedom for workers like you and me. Dear miner, they will slave you till you can't work no more. And what do you get for your living but a dollar at the company store? A tumble-down shack to live in, snow and rain pours in the top. You have to pay the company rent, and you're paying it never stops. I am a coal miner's wife, I'm sure I wish you well. Let's sink this capitalist system in the darkest pits of hell. So I get to have it. I get to feel it. I get to be with her.
Yeah.
But then it's okay to let go.
Yeah.
We did it.
Mm-hmm. And it's a container, but it also, it touches other people also.
That's the hope.
Mm-hmm. That actually was a kind of an amazing demonstration of something that I was going to read to you, Bela. This is from a blog called The Rabbi's Pen. Have you ever heard this? My crack producer, Lily, found this for me. Spiritual Reflections on Bela Fleck and the Flecktones.
By
a rabbi. Oh. I couldn't find the rabbi's name. Music is a language, a way
I might have posted this.
All right, well, we'll take it with a grain of salt. Music is a language, a way of communicating, a vehicle for bringing greater peace, tolerance, and humor into our own hearts and into the world. Music is a spiritual discipline and a great teacher. Great musicians like Bela Fleck and the Flecktones are also great teachers. Do you ever think of yourself? Do you ever think of yourself as a teacher? Is that?
I don't know. I mean, I know there are people that learn from what I do, yeah. And it's exciting to see people that have taken what I do and built on it, just the way I built on Earl Scruggs and Tony Trischka and so many great people that I learned from.
Yeah.
But I don't formally teach very much, and in the past it was mostly because I was just so busy trying to do what I've been doing, you know. But I actually love teaching.
I think actually that act of teaching and that spiritual discipline was also just in that music you just shared. It's like it was an embodiment of this. This person also said at the Ryman Auditorium, Bela Fleck took a few moments to honor one of his teachers, the late Earl Scruggs. There was a palpable sense of reverence and holiness throughout the auditorium as many of us understood the great love that emerges when true teaching and learning have occurred. I don't know.
Well, there's a lot you can do with instrumental music, sometimes we tend to sideline it and think of it as background music or mm-hmm. support for vocals. Like a lot of times, I can't tell you how many times I've been playing with somebody for an audience, and the singer sings, and then as soon as we go into the instrumental part, people start talking. It doesn't matter who it is.
Really?
It could be with some of the greatest musicians in the world. It's like a go-to, oh, that's not the main thing, but, you know, go to India, you might have a very different experience of a spiritual experience listening to music. It doesn't have to be India, wherever you hear it, or even people hearing the great German classical music, you know, or Chopin can have a pretty ecstatic mm-hmm. experience through the works of human beings. But I think the great ones are trying to access this feeling when they play. And the pieces that I've come up with that have a strong mood or that kind of a component, I couldn't explain to you what I was going for when I was trying to write them. I might have found a sound that expressed a feeling or a mood that I tried to write a piece around, and I couldn't explain what that mood is even. But someone who listened to it would know exactly what I was talking about.
We are drawing to a close, and we're going to hear a little bit more music from you. Abigail, so one of the, I often will kind of circle around to this question of what you've learned through the life you've lived about what it means to be human and how perhaps that has evolved since, you know, your early days, things that you know now or believe now that or experience now that would have surprised you then. I feel, Abigail, that you've been really articulate about your wisdom in the commencement address you gave at Colorado College and also this beautiful TED Talk that you gave. And I'd love for you to reflect on that question. And I would also love for you to tell that story that you told in the TED Talk about the little girl. Because it seemed to be kind of a moment that crystallized that for you, how you think about this big question of why you're here and why you live your life the way you do.
I was in China after the big earthquake in 2008. I hope I'm right about that. The years are flying by now that I have a baby. And
they will continue to fly by.
That's what I hear. And with a friend of mine, we were making, Dave Liang, the Shanghai Restoration Project, we were making a record with the kids. And this actually happened before we came back to make the record. I went there just to see what I could do, because I had spent a lot of time in Sichuan. My great teacher who taught me my tremendous love for China, Old Lady Wang, is from Sichuan. And so I felt like I really had to go back to Sichuan and see what was going on with people there and how they were recovering. 80,000 people died are the estimates. And it was a lot more than that, and a lot of people affected. So I went around and joined a couple of friends who were doing a quake relief project, and they said, you know, why don't you just come play some music for the kids at these relocation schools? They had been taken away from their families at home because many of their homes were destroyed, and the parents had to stay there and rebuild them, so the schools moved to other places. And the kids were struggling so much. I mean, they were not only taken away from their homes, but they had lost a lot of family members, and they were living in these temporary trailers in a place they didn't know at all, with just their teachers there and their fellow students. So I said, just come play for the kids, and maybe it'll relieve their minds for a moment and just sing some music. So I did, and I had so much fun with the kids. And at the end of my performances, the kids would always come up to me and they'd say, you sang for us, now we want to sing for you, you know? And so most of them, I would listen to like 90 pop songs, Chinese pop songs, you know? You know, just... And it was very cute and fun. But this one girl came up to me and she said, Wang Da Jie, which means big sister Wang. Washburn is Wang. She said, Wang Da Jie, Wo Xiang Gei Ni Chang Yi Shou Ge Qi, Shi Wo Mama Jiao Wo De Ge Qi. Big sister Wang, I want to sing you a song that my mother taught me. And my mother died in the earthquake. And so she sat down on my lap and she started singing to me, and tears started coming down my face and she started to cry too. And I had this moment where I just saw this light shining from her and from me, and I felt so very connected to her and to everyone. And I just knew that I wanted to live, and I do want to live in that light as much as possible with her and with you and with everyone, and that's how I try to live my life. Yeah.
That is so lame.
He's so sweet.
Okay, your turn.
I didn't bring any tissues up here.
Bela Fleck. How do you think about what you've learned about what it means to be human that you couldn't possibly have guessed growing up in...
What's your favorite song? Do you like chocolate?
All right, come on.
What was the question again?
Yeah. What does the banjo teach you about life?
That's a better way to do it.
Okay.
Well, you know, I don't know. It's where I put my energy. You know, I feel like everybody, you've got a certain amount of energy in your life to devote to various things. And I've been putting most of my energy into the banjo for most of my life. And actually, what's interesting, I mean, I'm learning as much about life right now from having a child with Abby. Mm. And Juno is a great teacher, you know, and I'm what you'd call a type A psychotic musician. I've lived that way up till now, where I could make music the thing, the most important thing in the world. And in a way, I thought that's my job. My job is to, and I know it's not true, but make believe that the banjo and what happens with the banjo is like the most important thing in the world. And that's why that's what I do. That's my job.
That's the privilege I get to
experience is like just like a great physicist has to believe that's the most important thing in the world to do the kind of work he wants to do. But once you have a kid, all of a sudden, it's clearly not the most important thing in the world. And so there's a lot of growing up that comes with that, because it's a different world. So the challenges now are how to keep the commitment that I made to this guy while keeping the commitment that I made to this girl and the guy who's the little guy
the
who's at
home. The Holy Banjo Emperor.
Yeah. So the Holy Banjo Emperor. Yeah. Yeah. So that's a challenge, but we're figuring it out together, and I'm finding that it's okay not to wake up and go work on hard music all day and just stop and spend all morning with watching this little kid full of wonder at these things, you know. That's the best I can do.
Well, it's great. It's been a real joy and an honor to dive deeply into what you do and who you are, and I'm glad you're in the world, and thank you. Thank you for making yourself available for this. And thank you, all of you, for coming. And now they're going to play some music for us again.
Hi, guys. Would you guys sing with us? Yeah? All right, this is an old song that was recorded on a porch in Merle's Inlet, South Carolina in the 1930s. And maybe we should try to learn it first. Although I think you're going to learn it really fast. So just warm up your voices. You got to get the lips going. Come on. Life is just so much more fun when you do that. Okay. The world can't do me no harm.
I got the keys to the kingdom. The world can't do me no harm. I'm gonna sing that a lot. Take old John on the island, place him in a kettle of oil. Then the angels came from heaven down and told him that the old wooden bowl. I got the keys to the kingdom. The world can't do me no harm. I got the keys to the kingdom. The world can't do me no harm, yeah. Take old Paul inside Alice, place him in jail below. Then the angels came from heaven down and unlocked the prison house door. I got the keys to the kingdom. The world can't do me no harm. I got the keys to the kingdom. The world can't do me no harm. Take it, Flick.
Everything you got. I got the keys to the kingdom. The world can't do me no harm. I got the keys to the kingdom. The world can't do me no harm.
Thanks for singing.